We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
From the corner of Broadway and Battery, this is the Damon Bruce Show on 95.7 The Game. Now, Damon Bruce.
Really good to have you here today. A very important day, obviously. 9/11, I know a lot of people are talking about where they were. We will get into that. The role that sports played in the healing process is a significant one. It's kind of a beautiful moment for sports and a horrific moment for the country. We were having an awful lot of beautiful moments yesterday. We were really enjoying the show that we were doing. And then all of a sudden, look, Antonio Brown's breaking news around 5:30 was something that sort of stopped our fun in its tracks. And I just want to address that before we do anything today, because I want to put it on the table and then take it off the table quickly. It is a deplorable story where, Matt, you said very well yesterday with Ray Ratto and Matt Kolsky, either he did this or she's lying, and either way, independent of any and all Raiders, Patriots, football, anything, there is nobody in sports whose name is less welcome on my radar right now, and I'd rather move on without him.
Yeah, and I think this is something we get into a little bit every time one of these just horrible stories crosses our radar and becomes something we have to talk about. Is, first of all, clearly that's not why we're here. If this was the sort of story we wanted to address, we'd have a different job. And, a lot of people will say, well, I don't know if I'm equipped. I feel like I'm equipped to do it. I just, at a certain point, I don't know what to say. And I said this yesterday, too. We know from data, from statistics, overwhelmingly, the right course of action is to believe women, because the overwhelming majority of the time, they are telling the truth when accusations like this happen. But as you said, either way, it's a crap story because the heinousness of the crime may vary, but a crime has been committed here one way or the other. And I don't know what to say, because either he did it and he's a scumbag and I hope he never plays again, or he didn't do it and the other side is a scumbag and it shouldn't affect his career. So for now, I have no idea what happened. I have no idea what to believe. I have no data.
Well, you don't have to draw the conclusion. That's the thing, is there's no conclusion to draw, and you have to be comfortable with that.
Yeah.
That said, you're right. The vast majority of these cases that women bring are when they are a genuine victim, and you saw immediately why there's no value in bringing a false case, is that she was basically dragged through the mud within an hour of the story. Just basically she was accused of basically trying to extort him. And there's no proof for that except for a lawyer's statement. So her reputation is damaged even if she's just the victim. So there's no benefit to throwing out a false charge, because truthfully, when you're doing that with someone with money and power like Antonio Brown, he has a lawyer who will be his pit bull. And I'm not saying that that's the case here, but if you have to bet, as crudely as that sounds, that's probably the way to bet.
Yeah, a lot of people would say, well, she's just trying to extort him. This is a very self-incriminating way of going about doing that. It's something that is so not what I signed up to talk for about when I did, wanted to talk about sports for a living. Let me just say this. If you're ever using the NFL to try to solve your societal woes, you're going through the wrong place to do it. And the only element of any question that I would have that I would think would bring this to any sort of level of, all right, well, there is something to talk about, would be, I just have this simple question. Because I think we all saw the picture of Tom Brady and Antonio Brown posting a selfie online. Did Tom Brady know this was coming before he agreed to take that picture?
Oh, I think it's safe to say he did not.
Yeah, and this is just, you know, one, I guess, nice little wrinkle of having Antonio Brown in your locker room now. You got to take all that comes with him. And there used to be a considerable amount of talent that made me want to ignore a lot of the off-the-field stuff. Now, to me, he is in that category of, I don't care anymore. I'd rather you just go away. Whether you be vindicated, whether you be guilty, I'm done talking about you. You've ruined so many conversations about the sport that I love, about a sport that I'm excited about launching again this year. You are on the wrong side of all of it. Of all of it. You seem to be a bad teammate, bad negotiator, bad faith everything. The emails, if they were by you to this woman, were just horrific, even if you were trying to say you're not guilty of anything.
You don't seem like a good dude, whether you're guilty of a crime or not. That's clear.
Right. And just look, I want to leave it at this. Joe Giglio on Twitter just brought up something that, you know, Occam's razor, just sometimes an easy explanation is really all you need to know. The Pittsburgh Steelers took a $21 million cap hit to get rid of the guy. When you've got an all-time great player and you're willing to sacrifice that much to get rid of him, like, that's the sign you're dealing with someone who's hard to describe as a good dude. I'm not saying he's a bad dude, but if you're willing to eat a $21 million bullet on a guy who is prodigiously producing for your franchise, there's a lot in that message, whether you want to agree to it or not. There's a ton in there.
Well, I think, you know, first of all, that, you know, football is not a place to go for anything other than football. And even at that, they don't present it well. But if you're looking for a morality play or pure enjoyment without the outside world encroaching, that's done. There's no escape now. There hasn't been an escape for a long time. And this is merely the latest example of that. Beyond that, though, it's the Steelers did look the other way, and they looked the other way a lot. So it's not like they were completely, you know, noble in just saying, well, we'll eat $21 million to get rid of him. They helped move this process along. They helped make Antonio Brown a problem. The Raiders did it in their way. The Patriots will do it in theirs. Because ultimately, the only thing that football really teaches you in terms of life lessons is that if you're good enough, you can be bad enough. That's it. I mean, and there will be a point where the Patriots can't stand it anymore. But for now, they're just going to go along as though, we're just going to use him until we can't use him anymore. He's basically just another piece of equipment there. And that's what you have to get used to. That's what this is.
What did the Raiders know about this before they said goodbye? What did the Patriots know about this before they said hello? Again, these are legitimate sports questions, but one I'm not even asking today because we have other things to talk about. Some of the stuff that we have to talk about goes right back to the NFL and what we're going to see, what we've already seen. Did we learn anything? And what do we know going into week two? We'll have a little overreaction for you before it's all said and done today. In terms of international sports overreaction, will the two of you be able to sleep at night knowing that Team USA lost to France on a basketball court today?
I'll sleep like a baby. I mean, because they went into this tournament with people not enthused about their chances, but they didn't go into this tournament with anybody thinking that you didn't like their chances against Rudy Gobert. Because that's how this played out. They didn't play well really against anybody, but Rudy Gobert and a lot of humans just handled them.
French humans.
Yeah, just basically that's it. I mean, France is not a basketball power. They will give you the occasional great player, but for the most part, they're well behind Serbia. They're well behind Croatia. They're well behind Spain. you know, they're not an elite European basketball power. And I don't know what this says about American players and their willingness to play overseas or anything else, but this was at no point did this look good, and this was particularly greasy.
Yes, all of that's true, with the possible exception of France is a pretty good team internationally, and they've got a few NBA players, not just Gobert. But I don't think that this is that surprising. I mean, I did not believe this team was the favorite to win the tournament. And if you had told me they lost to France in the quarterfinals, I wouldn't have been shocked. And if you had told me that on a key possession, they were left with Donovan Mitchell trying to take Rudy Gobert off the dribble and he got his stuff thrown out of bounds, I also would not be shocked. So this is what you get when the best players don't go.
Maybe the shock comes with the fact we're not shocked. And we'll get into that a little bit. We've got certainly some very interesting memories being shared today. Whenever the calendar hits 9/11, you have stories of remembrance. You have stories of heartache and tragedy. There are some inspirational stories. The stories that got wrapped in the flag are unbelievable. The stories that have been wrapped in sports are certainly something we're going to talk about. Our own experiences on that day, something that we will discuss this afternoon. We got a lot for you. A very interesting Wednesday afternoon. Who has a monster day of auditioning in Cincinnati? We're going to get into that. What do the nine? What would 2-0 mean? It would mean an awful lot. We'll talk about how rare it is for the 49ers and what it would mean going forward. We got a great guest list for you today. John Clayton in about 15 minutes from right now, the professor. We're going to go into the 49ers backfield with Matt Breida. A What If Wednesday. We'll say hello to Russ Ortiz before it's all said and done to get some memories from him. We've got a name game. We got a choose your own prize package for today's name game as well. And we hope that you plan on sticking around. A good one for you this afternoon with Ray and Matt here on the Damon Bruce Show. Hello, Elena. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. What's happening on the game brought to you by Dial Pad. 49ers are hanging out on the East Coast all week preparing for Cincinnati on Sunday. Running back Tevin Coleman will miss a few weeks with a high ankle sprain. With Coleman out, Matt Breida is going to step up in his absence. Breida also stepping into the spotlight today on the Damon Bruce Show. He's joining Rad Okolsky and Damon at 3 o'clock, so do not miss it. Special programming alert, 49er GM John Lynch will join Joe Lowe and Dibs tomorrow morning at 8 a.m., so set your alarm. You can also stream it live on the go by downloading the radio.com app and favoriting 95.7 The Game. We are playing the name game at 420. The winner gets a choice between two sets of tickets. Ooh la la, sponsored by Dialpad. Dialpad is changing the game for business communication. Host calls and meetings in the cloud, put a business line on your cell phone, and get analytics to make every call smarter. Over 60,000 businesses trust Dialpad to bring their phone system into the 21st century. Visit dialpad.com. I am Elena Matsourakis on the Bay Area's number one sports station, 95.7 The Game.
Now back to the Damon Bruce Show on 95.7 The Game.
Welcome, welcome. We got a good one for you today. We're about 15 minutes, less than 15 minutes at 2:30. The Professor John Clayton joins Ray Ratto, Matt Kolsky, and myself here on 95.7 The Game. We are very interested in talking about everything that happened in week one, what we learned, if anything at all, and what we can expect out of week two in the NFL, which of course begins tomorrow night. I mean, Thursday Night Football is just right around the corner. Good. Let's get it underway. Last night on ESPN, there was a 30 for 30 on Dennis Rodman. Did either of you guys see it?
I haven't watched it yet.
I did not because
it's in my queue.
Well, I should watch it. I probably will. But I've seen so many documentaries on Rodman of one sort or another, I didn't expect to be surprised. So I'm willing to test it out tonight.
You and I were riding in the same boat on this one, Ray. I did not need a 30 for 30 on Dennis Rodman. I fell into it almost accidentally. Like, I sat down, turned my TV on, and the last station I was on just happened to be ESPN. So I
you know, my TV fires up and it's in the middle of the opening segment of the entire thing. And it roped me in and I watched it all. And I'm going to tell you, it's worth the while. It is so many memories. This guy was equal parts ahead of his time, pushing everyone's buttons intentionally, unintentionally, crying on the inside, laughing at us because he's playing us all for a fool, all at the same time, an enigma wrapped in a riddle, wrapped in a moment, wrapped in a, oh my God, wrapped in a maniac, wrapped in a Hall of Fame quality player. I mean, he is insane. And the only thing that you can thank your, like, whatever God you pray to, thank that God that social media was not around when this guy was at the peak, because it would have broken the internet.
And I don't know that he would have lasted as long if just media in general coverage had been as scrutinous, let's say, as it is these days. What is it? We talked about this yesterday, I want to say. You always say about sports fandom that, like, 15 to 17 is where you're the craziest, most insane sports fan.
Between the ages of like 13 to 17, you're not quite a grown man yet, 18 years old, interested in getting a driver's license, going out with your buddies.
Right.
You're still like bound to the couch, hanging out with your dad. That's a cool thing, watching sports. Those middle teen years are powerful.
So Dennis Rodman played his first game for the Chicago Bulls 2 months after my 14th birthday.
Big deal.
We had a share of season tickets for those Bulls teams. So, like, in the most formative moments of my sports life, with my favorite team of all that I got to see live a handful of times every year, Dennis Rodman was, it was the most unbelievable sports story I'd experienced. I was just old enough to sort of understand how crazy the stuff he was doing was, and also to totally embrace it, being the sort of obnoxious twit that I am. One of my favorite players of all time, and obviously one of my favorite stretches of sports fandom in my life. So I'm very excited to watch this documentary, even though I'm sure there's not going to be a lot of new facts.
It's going to put you in a time machine. Like,
yeah,
wait until
exactly.
You go back to the Dennis Rodman, Phil Jackson, Jerry Krause, he's on the team press conference, which they had on a folding card table. Like, sports was so approachable and so informal and so unsold back then. It was really something else.
Well, it was sold. It just wasn't sold
every square inch
to the exacting measurement that it is now. And when you ask the question about what would Rodman have been like during the social media era, he would have probably gone through it the same way that he did now, which was burn the candle at both ends and down the middle, and then flame out about the time that he flamed out. Because for a while, he was really good at dancing one step ahead of the flame, and that coincided with the time when he was not only a really good basketball player, but someone who wasn't a one-dimensional basketball player. While he was with the Bulls, he had some shielding. It's once he left there that he became, by his own choosing as well as by circumstance, the guy alone.
Oh, yeah. Well,
that's, I think, the real lesson here. And again, I say this without having seen the documentary, but I think he spirals out of control when there isn't Jordan and Pippen and Jackson, among others, to basically hold him up.
Literally, the minute it ended in Chicago,
it went bad quickly.
Yeah, it spiraled.
He had a cup of coffee with the Lakers. They basically threw him off that team for partying too hard. He has a minute or two with the Dallas Mavericks. And what's really good about this is everyone has something to say about Dennis Rodman, from bodyguards to Phil Jackson, to Michael Jordan, who doesn't participate in anyone's documentary. He participated in this documentary. Dennis Rodman is the only dude in the world that was more famous than Michael Jordan, and he was on the same team. And he was at that point. When he came out wearing that wedding dress, selling that book, it took over
It was the front page of newspapers in Bangladesh. You know, Michael Jordan had not made the front page of the Bangladeshian Times, but it did Dennis Rodman did it.
It is pretty hard to imagine, given today's media circumstances, a guy averaging 5.5 points a game selling a book being a world-shaking media event.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it was Madonna. Helped him an awful lot in that regard.
It made perfect sense at the time.
Carmen Electra.
But yeah.
He was the guy who basically tore down the wall of sports celebrity to make it a global thing because he was willing to do the thing that you can't do and survive, which is I will embarrass myself and I will get away with it. And ultimately, you don't get away with it forever. But for a while, he did. And I think the wedding dress was probably the point at which I think a lot of people decided he jumped the shark. Because you can't, once you get to that point, you can't go back and be less weird. You have to go and finish the job on yourself. And I think we're looking at that, and I'm exempting the current legal stuff. And I think we're looking at that to a certain extent with Antonio Brown, which is at some point, you don't get to undo what you've done to yourself. You are who you decided you wanted to show people. Right.
You can't be normal again.
You can't even retreat toward normalcy. You have, you know, American culture doesn't allow it. What are you going to do that's worse than this? What are you going to do that's weirder than this? Because fame eats you, and there's no escape. And I think Rodman was among the first people to get crushed by the metric tonnage of global fame.
I think another commonality is that there is a sense with guys like this that part of what makes them great is the craziness, is the stuff that swirls around them, is their unique, bizarre behavior. And so because people are making money and winning games on the backs of their talent, there's not a lot of people who are super excited about going up to them and being like, you know what, chill out, man. Don't worry about the game right now. Let's get your mental health in order.
The only one who could put him in check was Michael Jordan. And the only check that Michael Jordan had over him was in the 48 minutes of the basketball game. And even then, Dennis would fly off the handle and get ejected and kick photographers and go way overboard. It's just a stunning look back at a career that flamed out so quickly you probably forgot a lot about it. And what I definitely forgot about is the role that Mike Silver, our very own Mike Silver, who we talk football with all the time, he wrote the very first piece about Dennis Rodman, where Rodman started touching the third rail of homosexuality. And that, in the mid-90s, was so far beyond the pale, ahead of its time. Again, Ellen DeGeneres had not swung the pendulum of America's opinion on this topic nationally quite yet. And it, whether he did it because it was part of him, who he really was, whether or not he exploited it. Like, it's all fascinating looking back at it. And that there's a truth, there's a little truth everywhere. And there's an awful lot of lying everywhere. And Dennis Rodman remains an enigma wrapped in a paradox, wrapped in a crazy person, wrapped in someone who will tell you that he wish he could spend more time with his mother, in front of his mother, and then immediately leave the room and ignore her for several years at a time, right after he cries at his own Hall of Fame speech about how he wants to reconnect with her, and then walks out of the back of the room, never calls her again. Like, he is just, he's a mental case.
And if you remember, that SI piece was the one where he's got the parrot on the cover, I want to say, and he's laid out in leather on like a spread.
Yeah, draw me like one of your French girls, Jack.
It was really a wild thing.
I have to ask you, because you're the only one who saw this, how much did they touch on the fact that the one real rock that he had to rely on, that he could always rely on, was Chuck Daly? And once he left the security of that, I think the process started.
The spiral of his, I'm more Dennis Rodman, the individual, than I am Dennis Rodman, the basketball player, is absolutely documented in him leaving the Pistons culture. The Pistons culture sort of kept him in check a little bit. Then he goes to San Antonio where he tries to be a superstar for the first time. And like David Robinson's like, like it's really funny to go back and look at their reaction to him. And then he is so far beyond the pale in San Antonio that by the time it comes to joining Chicago, he was their fifth choice out of five options.
Yeah, I mean, San Antonio is a terrible place to be an iconoclast anyway, because the only kind of iconoclast that has ever thrived in that place is Kawhi Leonard, who basically just says, leave me alone.
And what's really crazy is that they go through all of this. And Chris Conley was a guy on MTV News and Sports Illustrated, ESPN for a little while. Chris Conley, a member of the media, goes, so all of this, as crazy as it was, with everything that he did, wedding dress, Madonna, Spurs, Bulls, three-peat, all of it, rebounding titles, burning it at both ends, as crazy as all of it was plausible. And then they get into North Korea, which is simply implausible. And it's a fascinating documentary. We'll get back to it. We got some calls on it. We will absolutely pick your brains. There is a lot of member berries there for sure. But right now, John Clayton is on the line, appearing on the Dial Pad guest line. Dial Pad helps you make smarter calls. He is the professor, Schooled with a Professor, one of the best podcasts out there, host on 710 ESPN up in Seattle with Ray Ratto and Matt Kolsky here on the Damon Bruce Show. John, it's a pleasure to have you back on again. Thank you. How are you, sir?
Great. Anything up on Antonio Brown? Anything happening there?
Man, it's something else. It's almost like he has just become so unpleasant to talk about in any capacity. We almost opened up the show today saying we're happy to be done with him. I wonder how much longer it takes, John, for the NFL to feel that way.
Hard to tell. I mean, you kind of get the feeling that they may let the case go in court and see where it goes from there. Certainly, the text messages that were sent were just nasty. And I don't know if you can suspend anybody for bad text messages. It gives a bad image. There's no question about it, because, you know, very condescending to women, very nasty to women. And you kind of wonder, it's like, okay, what's happened in the last year or two that delayed her from making this lawsuit? I know that the Allegheny County people in Pittsburgh are now going to try to investigate it and see if they need to put charges in there. But this thing is just nasty. And, you know, you can see the way that the Patriots wrote the contract. That it's like they're just taking this on a day-by-day basis. Because just like the Raiders, you know, once he started missing meetings and missing practices and stuff like that, they knew they can void the contract and get out of the contract. It's the same thing for the Patriots.
Let's talk about the one thing we do know is how the league will or will not deal with this. She said she was willing to cooperate with the league, which is unusual for most victims of sexual assault who have been involved with a player. What should we make of that? And more to the point, what should we make of what seems to me an increasing reluctance by the league hierarchy to want to even get involved with these, is to just basically walk away from them whenever possible, and even when they probably should step in?
Yeah, the hard part is, first off, I can't guess how they're ever going to, because they've been so far up and down. I didn't think they were going to do the sixth game on Ezekiel Elliott. They did. I thought they were going to do something with Tyreek Hill, and they didn't. I mean, they're impossible to predict. But also, remember, it's like, the rule of Roger Goodell versus the rule of law is completely different. I mean, a league does occasionally and sometimes get involved with this and makes a suspension when they feel it's necessary, but you can't guess it. And there's no standard. I mean, that's the tough part about it. It's all individually judgmental on each of the cases. And in this one, you know, it's hard to read. You can see the team's taking the position that they're just going to let them practice, play, and let the league deal with it. And her offering to cooperate is encouraging that maybe she is right on this. But also, she says she needs a few days or a little more time before she cooperates. So when that time is going to delay any kind of decision by the National Football League.
So I'm going to move into actual football because I prefer it. And both Bay Area teams, I think, produced successful results. Obviously, they did. Do you have a sense for watching both games, which team is more like the one that we'll see all year and which maybe played a little over or under its potential in week one?
You probably say the 49ers, but also realizing the Tampa Bay Buccaneers are among the worst teams in football.
Right.
And Jameis Winston was giving gifts up, like mad. It was almost like Christmas in September with the interceptions and the mistakes that were made there. So, but I think there's more consistency and there's better talent right now on the 49ers. I think you have to have genuine excitement about the pass rush. You know, Nick Bosa and Dee Ford look great. Of course, it's not a great offensive line the Bucs are using. I don't know if you saw the third preseason game. I mean, it was almost like an open invitation to constantly hit Jameis Winston. You know, the Raiders, I think, played a little bit above where I thought they would be, but then the Broncos played much lower than I thought they can be. But also, Denver seems to have a bad matchup right now with Oakland. So overall, I mean, it was encouraging for both teams, but I still think the 49ers are the better team.
John Clayton here on 95.7 The Game. So they go to Cincinnati this week, and Richard Sherman, I mean, he looked like a man reborn now more than a year off of his ACL, Achilles recovery. He did have one gift wrapped to him, but he is also the kind of guy, look, he is so physical, I wonder how much the league is going to let him play the way he prefers to play, where he's almost challenging a flag on every single play.
Mm-hmm. No, that's the way he plays, because, I mean, he uses his hands so well, but then sometimes those hands get caught, and there's going to be certain crews. I think you almost have to study which crews call that more than any others, because if you can establish that, then you can kind of see what games he might have some trouble with it. But that was what he was taught, and he was probably the best at learning the way to use his hands like that. But that does have a tendency where he's going to get a few more penalties.
Toward the Raiders side, everybody seemed to be surprised that the players themselves weren't distracted by all the Antonio Brown stuff that happened while he was there. Were you surprised by that? Because my theory is that most players can put up with most things as long as it doesn't get brought into the clubhouse on a daily basis. And it seemed like the Raider locker room was free of most Antonio Brown stuff, including Antonio Brown.
Well, and I think that's why it probably wasn't as much of a distraction for them, because he wasn't there that much. I mean, he missed so much time. I mean, it's like he was out of sight, out of mind, even though everybody was talking about it. Everybody was, you know, involved in it. I mean, those type of things. But the fact that, you know, he stayed away so much, and then, of course, you look at how disjointed things were, you know, with the last two preseason games, in the sense that the team wasn't necessarily a team. You know, when you keep 41 players at home for your last two trips, and you have less than 50 players out there, I mean, it's hard to have the team be too distracted. I mean, because again, there was so much time away from it. I mean, they had probably the shortest time of any team, because, I mean, here's 2 days where they're not even get boarding a plane. You have 41 players staying at home. So that probably helped in being able to avoid all the distractions that was there. I mean, clearly, I mean, you got Hard Knocks and you got the Antonio Brown, and Hard Knocks came off easy. Antonio Brown came off hard, but what you saw was that I don't think it did affect the team as much, because he wasn't around as much.
John, how much does Jadeveon Clowney change the arc of Seattle season?
It basically puts them now from just maybe being a wild card team to a team that can challenge but still not necessarily win the division. But they're a much better team, and they're going to get much better. Now, again, I say that knowing that Andy Dalton, the Red Rifle, put up 418 yards against the defense, but so much of that had to be the style that they were using, because they actually played for the first time bend but don't break, and when they needed the big plays, they were able to get them. But Clowney came in and played 48 plays, and in a lot of those, I mean, he gave a rush that they hadn't had since Frank Clark was traded to Kansas City. And so when Ziggy Ansah starts getting on the field, which is probably going to be this week, you know, they're going to be much better with their pass rush than they ever expected. And if that's going to be the case, it'll make it easier for the defensive backs to start being in coverage. They may have to make one change at safety this week, because I think that Lano Hill is going to start for Tedrick Thompson. But, you know, what, like, for example, Clowney, with the double teams that he started to get, opened it up on the other side for Quentin Jefferson, who really nobody hardly knows about. I know him because he went to my high school. But he had two sacks, batted passes, and had a career day with six tackles. And so when Clowney gets doubled, the guy on the other side, whether it's Ziggy Ansah or somebody else, is going to be open more, and that's going to lead to a pretty good pass rush and a much better defense.
How would you – well, I'll just put it this way. Front seven only, Seahawks or Niners?
I'd say right now Seahawks. Because I think where the Niners are is that they're more in that 8-9 team range. And before the Clowney trade, that's probably where the Seahawks were too. But I think Clowney, you know, can probably jump everything up a notch or two, because, you know, what you're looking at is that the offense, even though it did poorly on Sunday, is still going to be one that's going to score 25 to 27 points a game. And now the defense should be better enough to at least give up 20, you know, gave up 21-7 last year. I think they'll be better, but it's going to take a few weeks before the defense settles in. So overall, I think that the, you know, the Seahawks have a better chance to challenge the Rams than the 49ers do.
John Clayton here on 95.7 The Game. What do you think keeps Kyle Shanahan up the most at night in Youngstown as the Niners get ready to take on the Bengals? The fact that he lost another starting running back to injury, or he doesn't have a young wide receiver really emerging from the pack yet?
I think the young wide receiver thing, you know, because the one thing, say what you want about the Shanahan family, they seem to do well with whatever back they can find, you know, because now Matt Breida can come up and do a good job. It does hurt that, you know, they keep losing backs, but I think that can do it. But you're right. I mean, you know, the wide receiver position right now is very much in question, and somebody needs to step up. That's why it hurt that Dante Pettis, whatever reason, didn't do too much in the first game, because they basically don't seem to have a good number one. You know, they're kind of in that twos and threes, but those twos and threes got to start emerging and playing like twos and threes.
How, given the fact that it looks like the Dolphins are, whether they want to or not, running a fire sale, how many phone calls are they getting right now for what few players they have that are still worth a damn?
Well, let's put it this way. My read on it is that they're getting more calls from the agents and the players on the team to get them out of there. They are getting calls for the players on the team. And it's not only just a worse thing than maybe even the Florida Marlins, because right now, you know, they look like a Division II football team as opposed to an NFL team. I mean, they just look horrible. But, you know, they've pretty much given away most of their guys. Now, what I can't understand is how Brian Flores is using some of his players. Like, for example, Rashad Jones is a Pro Bowl safety. Okay, he played about 35 plays, and in seven of the eight touchdown drives, he was barely on the field. How do you take one of your better players, who you figure they're going to trade him, is going and don't even put him on the field for half the game? And I don't get that. And you know, they open up against four playoff teams from last year, so you know they're going to be 1-3 and 0-4, and at the bye week in week five, that's going to probably go to Josh Rosen. But this thing is bad, and there's not a lot of players, because think about last week. They took a 53-man roster, and they made 12 changes. 12.
It's a lot.
That's about as many as I've ever seen.
But I guess the question that hits me is, since they're trying to lose anyway, there should really be no surprise about how they use anybody, and it does lead to the question whether Brian Flores actually has freedom of action to be the head coach.
Yeah, you would have to think so, because I can't imagine Chris Greer is you know, wanting all this to happen. But I think Flores has, you know, authority in how he puts the players on the field. The problem is he just doesn't have any players.
Dolphins fans, enjoy your season of asset protection as they wait to be traded. I guess that's where we are.
John, which ones? I guess the only difference between the Marlins and the Dolphins is the fact that you know, the Dolphins do draw more than 7,000 a game.
Ouch! Thank you very much, John. I really appreciate it as always. Thank you for your time.
Okay, thanks,
John Clayton. Up in Seattle, Schooled with a Professor podcast. Always great to talk to him. When we come on back, we got a lot of people on hold. Want to talk a little Rodman, want to talk about the news du jour with Antonio Brown. I guess we'll delicately allow that to happen, but not for long. And some memories about what today means, obviously it being the anniversary of 9/11. That's coming up, along with 49er running back Matt Breida, all courtesy of Fremont Bank. Full service banking. No compromises.
Now back to the Damon Booth Show on 95.7 The Game.
Nothing says this is going to be a great segment like picking up your headphones to do a segment and they break instantly. That's what just happened. I think I just put them back together. Welcome back to 95.7 The Game.
Do both ears work?
They do.
Didn't break it.
Frankly, that's progress.
That's not bad. I thought it was
going
to be a lot worse.
You defied the laws of electronics.
With Ray and Matt, good to have you here. This is Fillmore Mike in San Francisco, waiting patiently. What do you got, Fillmore Mike?
Oh, man. You got a coaster. You're going to love the 30 for 30. You know, we around the same age. Ray, I know you're going to love it, too. But they did touch upon his childhood. I loved how they touched upon his childhood, what he went through. It was crazy. The man grew like 11 inches after the age of 18 or 20. So I remember reading his book, and I remember in the school he went to in Oklahoma, he averaged a lot of points per game. When he got to the NBA, like you said, Ray, he idolized Chuck Daly. And like you said, Damon, the Pistons culture kind of like grounded him. And what John Sally made a key point when he said, Dennis didn't understand the business of basketball even back then. He was like, he was 26, but he was like super still a child.
Totally. So he didn't understand the business of business, much less the business of basketball. I mean, the guy was the number one best-selling author in the world for a week or two, which is, by the way, enough to give you the kind of money that will last you the rest of your life. And he squandered it all, like, on gin and tonics and strippers.
Quickly.
Because when the thing about money is that if you don't know what $50 means, you can't hold on to $50 million. I mean, because you do goofy stuff with it because you think it will always be there. Antoine Walker is the unmistakable king of going through money.
Right. Yeah. And he had a gambling problem, though, didn't he?
Well, he had a gambling problem, but he had an everything problem. It was a spending problem because you don't know what anything is worth.
And he also was the classic 18 people on the payroll from, you know, people he knew growing up, it wasn't just Antoine going through Antoine's money. He had help.
This dude lays out my clothes. This dude picks my T-shirts. This dude rolls my joints. Yeah. This dude carries my weed. This dude
exactly
puts gas in my car.
I also think there's something to, you know, it's like when we hear people say, "Well, that guy's got billions of dollars. Why is he being stingy over 50 cents?" And it's like because that's who he is, and that's a huge part of why he became a guy with $50 billion. Is he was super careful with every penny and washed every penny like a hawk and made the absolute most of them.
It's amazing how many people with a ton of money are good at managing money and make prudent decisions that are based almost on, am I making, earning, or wasting money? So often.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, as is often the case, can I get somebody else to pay for this? Because that's another way to keep your money.
888-957-9570. Ray in Fairfield. Hello, Ray.
Hey, what's good, man? Great show. I love what y'all are doing.
Thank you.
I just wanted to touch on the AB situation a little bit. I'm by no points a fan of his, but I just want to make sure we take into account separating how people act within their sport and in real life, because this story actually leaked on Twitter. I saw it late Friday night. And it was basically the accuser Spring telling Antonio Brown, heads up, this is about to blow. Now, this happened before he even signed with the Patriots. So I'm trying to figure out how it didn't hit the news until 4 days later, unless it's a little strategic, you know what I mean? I think Luke Walton went through a similar situation when he became the head coach with the Kings. They dropped his information immediately upon, you know, him making that milestone. So,
well, you know, I hear the point that you're making. I don't want to correlate the two because there is no real correlation to make other than these are stories you never want to be involved in. There's an awful lot of tea being spilled, if you'd like to say, on what's going on with Antonio when this news started to break, the warnings he got, the news of it's coming, it's not coming, the harbinger of it all. The whole thing is just the whole thing is steeped in less than noble, that's for sure.
It's distasteful.
Yes.
But the timeline still has yet to have been established fully.
Been this outcry is too strong, but there has been at least a moderate whimper from some corners of, well, but how strange is the timing? And I got to be honest, I don't even know what that means. Like what? Like the because he had a weird football contractual situation with the Raiders, now's the time to have a lawsuit for rape? Like, I don't... The timing to me is relatively meaningless, unless we're talking about should the Patriots even have signed him. But I think we know the Patriots don't care unless he's not going to be able to play. So to me, the issue of timing is...
Well, and I would need to know an awful lot more about... First of all, when the victim chooses to report a crime... is not an element of timing I'm willing to discuss.
Exactly.
Or
like, it's not.
I also do not know the machinations of, hi, I'm here to file a civil lawsuit, and then that civil lawsuit becoming public record and then blooming into the news cycle. I don't understand quite the steps there. What is odd timing? What I just know about how busy it is to probably plan a lawsuit against someone of this stature and a wedding is you usually don't do it in the same week. And the reason why she is unavailable to talk to the NFL is because she's also getting married this week.
Yeah.
Which just is another, I mean, there are an awful lot of odd layers and I don't know what they mean. And I don't want to be the one to try to discern what they mean. My goodness, by the way, there is a Dolphins beat writer named Omar Kelly, who I like very much. And he is way over his skis with some in public presumptions about what is really happening here that I don't know if a journalist can honestly survive in 2019.
Yeah.
I'll be interested in if Omar Kelly makes it to week three as much as any player in the NFL. Very odd times.
Yeah, I mean, there is a significant amount of time between the time that a victim reports anything to the police and it goes to the district attorney for filing. So it's not a question of when the lawsuit was announced. It's a question of when she went to the police, and it would seem that it would, in all likelihood, have predated probably even training camp, because it takes a long time for a district attorney to vet what would be investigating a crime against somebody rich and powerful, who Antonio Brown clearly is, because district attorneys are politicians, and they don't want to aim high and miss because it doesn't help them get reelected. So I'm guessing that this has been in the works for minimum a couple of months.
For the record, I don't believe she did go to the police, which is part of the confusion here.
This is why this is a civil trial, not a criminal trial.
Right. She filed a civil trial. There is
but it still had to be investigated.
Right. Presumably someone's investigating it, but that is... And again, as Damon said, and I think maybe the biggest point in terms of timing is none of us have any... She could have filed the lawsuit a year ago, and it takes that long to filter through the system. I have no idea how that works.
I don't know. I was here to talk about huddles and tackles quarterbacks and shotgun and all sorts of things that aren't this.
Well, but that's the nature of everything now.
Yeah, it is.
I mean, Antonio Brown. I mean, I said this yesterday, and Matt was right to say I'm not sure that that's the point, but it's the point now. You're not getting away from this. This is not going to be a football season unless Antonio Brown is dancing through it every couple of days.
What I guess I'm trying to say is I think I'm really well qualified to answer many there are no stupid sports questions. I am not well qualified to answer questions of legal machinations, civil lawsuits, and sexual assault cases, and how things go through the Florida state system. Like that's what I mean when I say I am unqualified to talk about, not incapable of, don't have the skill to. We could talk about this, but I'd prefer not to because I have no authority to speak with any clarity on what the hell just happened, and I don't think any of us do.
Well yeah, and that's the thing. Even if the three of us had taken courses in the best way to
discuss and process rape allegations. It doesn't give us any insight into what actually happened in this case.
Right, and I didn't go to the California or the Florida Bar Association. No. I don't know how quickly legal work gets crunched in the state of Florida. Knowing what I do know about the state of Florida, I'll just assume it's a minus. It's not a plus. It's not. Cracker Jack smooth operation.
Yeah, but I'm not saying that any of us are going to know anything. I'm just saying that it's going to insert itself in the day.
Yeah.
Whether anybody likes it or not, this is now part of the deal in the NFL in 2019.
Matt Breida is going to be joining us in just a few minutes here as we move into our 3 o'clock hour. Looking forward to talking a little football with the 49ers running back as they make a layover in Youngstown, which, Elena, I love you. You said they're staying on the East Coast. Trust me when I say Youngstown, Ohio is nowhere near the East Coast. Love you, though.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.